I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The European Union started as a dream. After three massive wars in less than a century, France and Germany, and the countries in between and allied to them, agreed to form a common market and then a closer union. By the mid-1990s, the European project had grown to 15 countries, most of them moving towards forming a single currency. And just recently, the EU opened its border even further to include 10 nations, some of which had been behind the Iron Curtain, into the heady new Europe with open borders, open markets, and brotherhood. But a funny thing happened on the way to unity. The citizens of the individual nations decided the EU was offering too much openness, and so earlier this month, voters all over the continent showed their displeasure by electing large numbers of anti-European Union types to the European Parliament. The election result had less to do with EU politics than it does with something else: anti-immigration fears. Europe is a crowded place, and it's getting more jammed all the time. 380 million people live inside the European Union, in a geographical area not much bigger than the United States, east of the Mississippi. Last year, migrants accounted for three-quarter of the area's population growth. We're talking about Europe's identity crisis in this hour, Connection listeners. Will Europe ever embrace the American melting pot model of population growth? Is fear of immigration just a continuation of Europe's age-old xenophobia? Or does it reflect new realities and new threats to stability and security? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, the numbers to call to join in the conversation. And I'd like to introduce first Jocelyn Cesari, who's the Senior Research Fellow and Visiting Professor at the Harvard University Center for Middle Eastern Studies. She's on a phone line from Middlebury, Vermont, where she's taking the immersion course in Arabic. Hello, Jocelyn.
Hi, hello.
Now, let's be honest. If you're taking the immersion course in Arabic, you're not supposed to be speaking any other language, right?
Yes, right. I am, yes.
So you're breaking the rules to talk to us.
Yes.
Well, we appreciate that. Let me begin by asking you, what was really behind the incredible surge of anti-European voting in the recent European Parliament elections?
My impression is that Europeans are going through a deep identity crisis, and they are not sure anymore about the future, not so much about the economics, but the culture, the rules, the norms of this future new political entity. And the political discourse they get at different level in their countries doesn't help them in understanding what are the issues, what should be the priorities.
The political discourse in the countries, and this is for listeners who don't follow European politics closely, the European Union pools sovereignty on certain key issues, most importantly trade, but then country by country they're each sovereign with their own parliaments, their own leaders, and the debate is very much about where whether closer European Union means giving away sovereignty.
Right, that's exactly the issue. In different European countries, some political parties and even politicians in mainstream parties are, you know, addressing or sending a message about European bureaucracy, about the sort of, you know, this would be just another level of bureaucracy and how would this be really a progress? And you know, there are some doubts emerging. And people don't know exactly, you know, it's not, it's very bureaucratic, it's very, lots of procedures, and people, especially young people, need motivation that are more, I would like to say, symbolic or politically exciting. And this is not the message coming from Brussels.
But why has so much of the anti-European Union feeling coalesced around this immigration issue?
This is not new, first. At different times, let's say since the last 20 years, even 30 years, the question of immigration has been a very important political part of the political debate, because it also addresses this question of national identity, status of religion in public life, and Europeans are feeling like they are losing their main values, norms, and identity points, and this is very important. They see new immigrants not so much as a threat in the job market, but as a threat in their identity as nationals of different countries. European, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure if at different levels people are really feeling like European, culturally speaking. I'm not talking about economics or facilities to travel and communicate. I'm really talking about culture here. And but it's seen as a threat at the national level, national identities, culture, and so on, and values, yeah.
All right, Jocelyn, stay with us. I'm now going to bring into the conversation Urs Üçüncü, who is in a studio in Cologne, Germany, and is the General Secretary of the Islamic Community organization Milli Görüş. Hello, Urs.
Yes, hello. I'm listening.
Good. Now you heard what Jocelyn was saying. You lead this large organization in Germany. It's mostly Turkish people. Turkish immigrants make up, is it the bulk of immigrants into Germany in the last 20 years?
Pardon, I did not understand.
Most immigrants into Germany in the last 20 to 30 years, do they come from Turkey?
Yes, they definitely come from Turkey. It's 2.7 million people from Turkish background.
And when you hear conversations about identity politics, it's a community that's, you know, well established. How do you respond to people who express fears about lost sense of, you know, German identity because there's what they consider to be a large Turkish immigrant community?
Yes, the matter is, well, what do you consider under German identity, or is something like German identity? Do we have to rebuild something new, what we call European identity, where Muslims also find their identity within these European borders? Because if you try to divide between German, Turkish, Spain, French identity, I think we just avoid this building up of this place called Europe.
The idea, though, of building up this place called Europe has stalled. You've seen that.
No, I just see that people, especially in the elections to the European Parliament, just showed their anger about the governments in their countries. But the idea of Europe still lives on, especially in the young generation.
I'm going to bring into the conversation now Neil Ferguson, who's the Herzog Professor of Financial History at the Stern Business School in New York University, and he's also a senior research fellow at Jesus College. Neil, hello.
Hello, Michael.
Now, you've been listening to the conversation so far. What is your read on why the anti-European Union feeling has coalesced on the issue of identity?
Well, I think we have to be careful here. Part of the problem that manifested itself at the recent elections to the European Parliament was the familiar problem of apathy. But this was apathy squared. I mean, this was, in most countries, the lowest turnout in European elections there's ever been. I think many Europeans voted by not voting in the sense that they expressed an indifference to particularly the institution of the European Parliament, but perhaps more generally to the project of European integration as it's officially articulated. And that rather left the field open to the more radical anti-European parties, like, for example, the UK United Kingdom Independence Party, which did terribly well in Great Britain with a straightforward withdrawal from the EU, withdrawal from the European Union platform. So an important factor here has been a kind of loss of enthusiasm as much as a radicalization of the European electorate. The people who are anti the European Union are still, in almost all countries, quite a small, if vocal, minority. There's another issue altogether, which I think is the question of immigration. And I think what's happening is that anti-European politicians, and this has been going on, as Jocelyn rightly said, for some decades, have seen that the best way of garnering votes is to turn an anti-European Union argument into an anti-immigration argument.
And the other thing is that the European Union itself is seen as being a project of the more liberal minds, shall we say, in and around Europe. Certainly Margaret Thatcher declaimed frequently about the socialists administering the place in Brussels, and it is it's a place where both, you know, the kind of right-wing nationalism and the sense that some entity out there is imposing a more liberal worldview on us coalesce, and you can personalize it by pointing to the new people who've arrived in your country.
Right. Obviously, the European project appeals both to moderate conservatives, Christian Democrats, and to moderate socialist social democrats, and it tends not to appeal to extremists on both ends of the political spectrum. But the issue of immigration has an economic dimension that very few European politicians are willing to talk about out loud. The reality is that in almost all of the major European countries, there is a demographic crisis in the making, and that takes two forms. A, the birth rate of, say, for example, the typical German family is now below the replacement rate, that they're having on average less than two children per couple. And that means that the absolute population of Germany is going to decline over the next 40 years. Meanwhile, enduring lifespans mean that that countries like Germany, Italy, Spain, Greece are becoming really senile. When Donald Rumsfeld talked about old Europe last year, he didn't realize how very right he was, because there are countries in Europe that are genuinely getting old, in that something like 30% of the population of Italy by 2050, according to the UN, is going to be 65 or over. So if you go to Italy, imagining you're going to have a romantic fling with some delectable young Italian stud, you're going to be disappointed, because you're going to meet a bunch of old age pensioners by the middle of this century. Why immigration is happening. It can't really be resisted credibly on economic grounds. It's obvious that these societies need immigrants, if simply in order to staff, to take one obvious example, the British National Health Service.
Neil, let me just interrupt for a second, and because we're coming to the end of the segment, I just want to quickly ask Jocelyn, particularly in France, the Muslim population there has been growing, but since the Algerian War. Now, is it assimilating, or is it being pushed to one side, these third generation born in France?
It's both, meaning if you look at individual practices, especially regarding religion and culture, you can see signs of deep acculturation among young Muslims from second, third, and sometimes even fourth generation. If you look at the way they're going to interact with the French society because of a dominant discourse that puts Islam always at stake in the relationship between this particular group and the rest of the French society, people tend to use Islam or to have collective identities around Islam also as part of their way of interacting. You know, identity formation is really a two-way process. It's how you are seen and how you react to this perception from outside. And if you go into a North African family today, you'll be surprised how little people do in terms of cultural practice and even religious practice.
Jocelyn, I'm sorry I have to interrupt you. We're coming to the end of the segment, and I know you have to go back to speaking Arabic. So thank you for joining us. Connection listeners, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour, Connection listeners, about Europe's identity crisis. Is fear of immigration just a continuation of Europe's age-old xenophobia? It's the reason why so many Europeans ended up here in America. Or does it reflect new realities and new threats to stability and security? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call to join in the conversation. Let me go back to Öz Üçüncü, who's the General Secretary of the Islamic Community organization in Germany, Milli Gorusch. It was just before the break, Jocelyn was saying that for immigrants, it's a two-way street. It's how you see out from your place in society and how society sees you. Has that changed in your experience in these last few decades in Germany?
Especially it's changed for the immigrants themselves, because there was a certain change of perspective, because when they came 43 years ago, they just wanted to go back after a few years. But now the second and third generation of immigrants, and even the fourth generation, is not thinking of returning. It's just sees its future within the borders of Europe and living in the European societies.
And the notion that Turkey is sort of poised just at the edge of Europe gives it a slightly different relationship, I suppose, than more recent immigrants coming from Arab countries.
Yes, the perspective of Turkey entering the European Union is also a perspective that will be helpful for the integration of the Turkish people living already within the European borders. So Turkey is also an integral part of this European family, and so it should be seen in this way, and it is the expectation especially of the Turkish immigrants in Germany and in Europe itself.
Neil Ferguson, in your observations of Muslim communities in different European countries, are they not just different communities reflecting those differences that, you know, that nationalists would find are worth supporting, and that's why they're against greater European integration?
There's enormous diversity. You can encounter Muslim immigrants to the United Kingdom who live in an entirely assimilated way, who in no way live in what I suppose were once called ghettos, with reference to Jewish communities in Western Europe. You can go to suburbs of Marseille in France and see what look very like Muslim North African ghettos. You can go to a city like Hamburg or Berlin, both cities I've lived in, and encounter in the German Turks or the Turkish Germans, perhaps the most assimilated of all the Muslim groups in Europe. There is a great deal of variety here, and I think that's an important point to bear in mind. A lot of the debate about Muslim immigration to Europe, and it's clearly a crucial issue here. There is a profound transformation happening to Europe's demographics, and when I talked about the aging of the West European population, I should also have talked about the rapid birth rates, the very high birth rates of Europe's Muslim neighbours. This is a big story, but it has very different endings in different contexts. I think where countries, and I think Germany is a good example, have self-consciously tried to be more liberal in their attitude towards immigration, the Germans above all had to learn from their historical catastrophe that racism was not a political option. And I think for that reason, immigration to Germany, and there's been a hell of a lot of it actually over the last two or three decades, immigration to Germany has been, in fact, quite a success story. But in France, which has, of course, the highest Muslim population of all European countries, it really is a much more fraught relationship, despite French pretensions to having a universal definition of citizenship.
Well, what's interesting to me, I'm just looking at some statistics here on population size and growth in Europe over the last 30 years. And I note that the countries that have shown the largest population growth in that period of time are the ones that have had the largest inward migration of Muslims. Germany, France, and even the UK, which is behind them, have had significant influxes of people from, in most cases, in Germany's case, it's Turkey, and that's a historical alliance that goes back to the Ottomans and the Germans in the First World War. And then you have groups coming from the former empires, and that's where many of these folks are coming from. And it's interesting to note that that is very clear looking at the statistics.
Yes, natural increase has been replaced by net migration as the principal driver of European population growth. And this, from a historian's point of view, is a dramatic turnaround. After all, for most of modern history, going back to, say, 1500, one of the dominant forces at work in the world was the overpopulation of Europe and the fact that there was net emigration from Europe Europe, not least to the United States, but indeed all over the world. Europe had a surplus of population at a very high birth rates and very high emigration rates. And this changed in the post-Second World War period gradually, but now quite decisively, so that now Western and indeed in Central Europe is a net immigration continent. And I don't think that in many ways Europeans have quite come to terms with this turnaround. Americans are used to thinking of their society as a society that can absorb immigrants, that's been, in a sense, absorbing immigrants from the outset. For Europeans, this is a real historical paradigm shift, and I think politicians and voters are having difficulty getting their heads around it.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. John is calling, I think, from Amherst, Massachusetts. Not Massachusetts, New York. My apologies.
No, no problem at all. We don't take offense. Well, we do take offense. I'm a conservative. But what I wanted to talk about was the EU is just a natural extension of the socialist mindset in Europe. And allow me to explain. This was developed by a bunch of, quote, intellectuals in a room saying, well, if we do all these things, we can all amalgamate. You know, it really is kind of a counter to the United States, but it will never, ever work because what these pointy-headed intellectuals did not take into consideration was human nature and the divergent type of socio-political
schisms
that they have in all these
countries. John, I want you to hold on to your thought for one second. I just want to put a question to you. In the 75 years prior to the EU, which was called the EC at that point, being set up, there were three massive wars between France and Germany, which by the end, if you totaled up all the dead, you're talking between 60 and 100 million people and the Holocaust. Now, since the EU was started, Germany and France have not been battening at each other. England may, Great Britain, the United Kingdom may stand aside from time to time, but everyone is tied in. You've had an unprecedented, in the modern era, and I mean modern in the long historical sense, unprecedented peace. Now, that has to be regarded as a form of success for the EU, don't you think?
Well, no. I mean, you're looking at the fact that it's either this or there would have been all-out turmoil. And quite frankly, I do believe that for the most part, people, especially in the Western world, are a lot more civilized than they were in the 40s and 50s. And it can be, things can be resolved over a table, but unfortunately, the majority of the real bad things that have happened in history have always been dealt with by force, World War I, World War II. But if I could just make one point, and then I'll get off the line, is that you've got different socioeconomic situations and realities in each of these countries, and it's all boiling down to things like productivity. What they want to do is they want to amalgamate all of Europe and have as many people in this little sphere, but you've got people, say, in Ireland, who are producing far, far more than the French. And you're all of a sudden trying to average all of this productivity and also things like tax rates. And this is all going to, it's going to fall flat on its face. It cannot survive.
Okay,
mathematically, it's an impossibility. And I'll say this will eventually fall on its merit because they're just so indebted with social obligations that they cannot fund.
Okay, John, I want you to stay there because I wonder if you have a particular question that you'd like to pose to Oz Ochunju, who's our guest representing the Muslim community. I mean, you're an American. Do you believe in the melting pot?
My goodness, it's absolutely worked. We absorb everything, Michael. We absorb every person. They figure 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 million illegal aliens, and they're working. They're taking money back to Mexico. It doesn't impact our economy like things like happening in France. France's entire goal in life, and I'm convinced of this, is to work hard to work less. They will do everything they can to work less hours per week, and, you know, that's not America. America, we just believe in working hard. We play hard. We may be edgy.
Okay. John, I want to thank you for your call. I want to put the question, though, to Urs. As a leading figure in an immigrant community, do you look towards the United States and think, why can we not get this concept kind of just generally accepted, not just in Germany, but around the European Union, that immigration doesn't mean the end of civilization as we know it and can actually be quite a good thing?
Yes, I just look to the U.S. and just sometimes dream of that the European societies themselves see the different cultures as an enrichment for the future. But nevertheless, we have got in Europe a strange discussion about leading culture, about the Judeo-Christian heritage. And when people talk about these issues, you get the feeling as a Muslim that you are not part of this place called Europe. But when I look to my history and to my heritage, to this place called Europe, I see Muslims in Andalus, in Bosnia. I see the Ottoman Empire. I see the Andalus Empire in Spain. So, and I see my heritage to the development of the Enlightenment area in Europe, to the development of with ideas of freedom, peace, and prosperity. And what I think is that melting pot might be a strange issue for Europe, because we just are keen on preserving our identity, but what we have to develop altogether is this thing called European identity, what you call US citizenship. What we have to develop is this European identity, where everyone with his culture and with his ethnical background gives his best in order to develop this place called Europe.
Neil Ferguson, as a historian, do you think that Erz has a point there, that the long contact, not always happy contact, but the long contact between Muslim societies and Europe has been ignored, Victor's writing history and so on, and should be restored? And might that help in reclaiming the Muslim strand in European identity?
I agree with everything Erz says about the Muslim contribution to European history. Of course, part of the problem has been the way that European history has been rewritten since World War II is essentially West European history. And it's still possible for West European politicians in France and in Germany to say that Europe is fundamentally a Christian civilization, forgetting not only what Urs has been talking about, but also the fact that Christianity as a religion has actually declined quite dramatically in Western Europe over the past 20 years. The truth about Europe, and particularly Western Europe, is that it's a secularized society in which religion plays a much, much smaller role than, say, in the United States. I don't think many of your listeners will quite realize the extent to which religious belief and religious observance have fallen off in both Western and indeed in post-communist Eastern Europe. So there's something very ironic about European conservatives saying how very Christian European culture is. And in reality, it's not that Christian at all. In fact, Christianity seems to be in really very steep decline in Europe, which is one reason, I suppose, why Islamic or Muslim immigration does strike people as alarming. Many Europeans aren't used to seeing people who genuinely believe in God and believe in regular religious observance. They've lived in this kind of secularized pseudo-paradise for so long that they find any kind of religious faith rather disturbing.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Laura is calling from Boston.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, yes, thank you for this topic. It's very interesting. I have a thought which may seem simplistic if you just first listen to it, but it seems that Europe has opened its borders, and that's a very good thing. But I wonder to what extent Europeans have opened their minds and change their thought paradigms, and instead of just fearing immigrants, to think of themselves as immigrants, perhaps to these countries, in North Africa. I mean, Europe is very comfortable in terms of its infrastructure and the economic things it can offer to people, but these countries have much to offer in terms of things like climate, also economic potential, you know, their rich culture. As an immigrant myself, I had to start thinking of myself as a citizen of the world, and it's really freed me up inside my mind, and it's been very good for me. And if large groups of Europeans or even, you know, individuals could see themselves as perhaps moving to a country like Turkey, you know, it would be good for Turkey and it would be good for them, and maybe the whole thing could work.
Lara, the trouble is, Lara, that what in fact happens is that Europeans do go to Turkey, but they go there for holidays.
Right.
Europeans tend to regard the hot periphery of the Mediterranean as a holiday destination, not as somewhere to settle.
Right.
The other key point, and it was raised both by you and by John, the last caller, is the extent to which, as compared with the United States, the European Union can offer new immigrants employment. The big problem, and one reason I think that immigration is a more sensitive issue here than it is in the United States, is simply that there is much higher unemployment in most European countries, particularly actually in Urs's country of the Federal Republic of Germany. Now, immigrants are almost always under more pressure socially, politically, in conditions of high unemployment than in conditions of low unemployment. That's an absolutely straightforward historical proposition.
Neil, the levels of unemployment, I mean, they don't relate to the fact that immigrants are taking jobs from people. There's a structural problem.
Of course they don't. No, this is a fallacy.
All of these, you know, any number of American economists will be happy to tell you that.
No, absolutely. I don't need to be told that as an economist myself. The key point is that what happens is that when right-wing parties are trying to mobilize people on a xenophobic anti-immigrant ticket, they most often have success among unemployed or blue-collar workers who see themselves either as having lost their jobs or being under threat of losing their jobs because of immigrants. Now, it's not true. It's an economic fallacy, but it is a consistent vote winner for parties that play that card.
Could you pick up Laura's point about people opening minds?
Yes, I just wanted to pick up this issue because opening minds is a key issue in Germany. We do not have a problem of immigration itself, so people quite appreciate when experts from India or other countries immigrate to Germany in order to bring their knowledge about technology to Germany. But what we have is we are missing a concept of integration for the already here living people. So when we see the Turkish community, we have got a history of 43 years now, and we're still talking whether these people stick to the or fit to the European society. So no one, especially the people with in the politics, developed a holistic concept for the integration of these people and for the integration of Islam. So when you just look on the German issues, you just see that the politicians leave it to the judges and courts to deal with the issues of Muslims. So when there is a lack of political will, and a lack of a kind of welcome that people appreciate that these millions of people are already here, you see that there is no real attempt of the people to open their hearts. So we lived here for 43 years next to each other, but without knowing each other very well.
Is fear of immigration just a continuation of Europe's age-old xenophobia? Or does it reflect new realities and new threats to stability and security? It's a difficult question to answer, Connection listeners. What do you think? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK is the number to call. To join in the conversation with Neil Ferguson, author of Colossus, The Price of America's Empire. He's been interested in the immigration problems in Europe. And with Özü Çuncu, who leads the Islamic community in Turkey. I'm Michael Goldfarb. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour about Europe's identity crisis, intensive immigration over the last 2.5 decades. Has called into question the whole process of European unity. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Konstantinos is calling from Cambridge.
Hello.
Hello.
I come from one of the two senile European countries that were mentioned earlier, Greece, which used to be a country of mass immigration and now has actually accepted about 10% of its population in immigration, mainly from Eastern Europe, but also people from the Middle East and Pakistan and further away. And I keep listening to the conversation so far, and I see one aspect, which is a certain xenophobic trait that have remained in society and also smart politicians that use them. But I don't hear the other part, which is that you have a large number of people that come for a better life. Sometimes they just assume that people believe that they just come to escape persecution, but in many cases just economic reasons. They come and they do not want to integrate. They want to take the advantages and have everything their way. And the fact that that rightfully causes problems to the population that's already there. that sees that it has to adjust, but they're not really adjusting.
And would you like to pose that as a question to
Urs? Well, I haven't heard that point at all. All I've been hearing is about how it's good, how population is actually aging, etc., which I see it very much in my country, though I would have to say that if the economic situation is better, Greeks would have more children than one. So it's not as simple as Greeks aren't interested in having more than one child, and I presume it's the same for Italians, and that the only solution is immigration. But what I'm seeing is nobody talks about the fact, like, education in their mother tongue. Even in this country, I see sort of a lot of talk about bilingual education, etc. Full religious freedom. That's all very fine, but there is no attempt to try and integrate. They want to be as they are and at the same time enjoy the full benefits. And to expect that that will not cause the rest of the population to fear that within them a foreign body is being allowed to grow is, I think, very pedantic. I mean,
Okay, Konstantinos, stay with us. I'm just going to ask Urs to comment on that point. In your community, within the community, a decision not to integrate, to embrace a more traditional form of Islam that perhaps puts one apart from the other Abrahamic faiths.
Yes, but it does not is not in contradiction about the values of Europe. When you stick to your religious belief and you do it under the religious freedom that the constitutions of the countries of Europe guarantee, it leads to a patriotism, constitution patriotism, and it leads to a critical discussion about your countries of origin, about the autocrat systems there, about the missing democracy. So you just keep another feeling for the societies you live in. I just want to also be careful with this word called adjustment. I just speak about integration. Integration means that I bring my culture, my background as an enrichment for this society, and I just want to develop altogether with others living in the same society the future of Europe. So when you stick to your culture, when you stick to your roots, it does not mean that you don't want to integrate or just want to use the advantages of these societies.
Yeah, but the truth is that this European identity is far from formed, and if you were leading your group and saying the best way to integrate would be to adopt a European identity, that European identity doesn't really exist. I mean, in essence, you know, Turkish immigrants in Germany must adopt, integrate into the German identity.
Yes, but I think Europe was always a place of visionaries. So the people, the men which built 50 years ago the European economic community, just have this vision of the European identity. And I think to the Muslims, European identity sticks the best. So I can't be a German. I can be a German citizen. But I can't be a German in this way that I just adopt German culture. I bring my culture. We try to build up this place called Europe. And so integration is this, you can call it a melting pot in the U.S., but we've got to build up the best and taking advantages of all these cultures and taking them at the enrichment.
There's a similar process that goes on in Britain at the moment, Neil, where you find that the notion of Britishness has been questioned since Scotland had its parliament devolved back to it when Tony Blair became prime minister. And so there's a resurgence of a Scottish identity and English identity, and the people who call themselves British, it's Black British.
Well, it's interesting you ask me this question, as I am, of course, a Scot by birth and spent my youth in that great country. Of course, Britishness was an invention of the Scots. It was It was really a Scottish notion to rechristen the Union of England and Scotland Great Britain in the hope that the English wouldn't mind terribly much if the Scots took it over and ran it, which we've been doing with some success since around 1603. Britishness, like Europeanness, is a construct. It's a form of identity that's been invented for a political purpose. And I think there's a sense in which Konstantinos has a good point when it comes to persuading new immigrants, particularly from Islamic societies, to accept even something as loose as a European identity, to say nothing of a British identity. It's not always done very effectively. I don't think Americans quite appreciate how sustained their system of creating Americans is, how effective it is, and how deliberately the United States goes about turning immigrants into Americans. Nothing comparable happens in the United Kingdom, and nothing comparable happens in the European Union. Now, in some ways, it doesn't matter terribly what people wear to school, something which has become a huge issue in France and a small issue in other European countries. And it doesn't terribly matter if, when cricket matches happen, Pakistani immigrants still support Pakistan. But there are some things that really do matter. If you are going to come and live in a country, you do have to accept not only its language, you have to use its language and learn its language, you also have to accept its laws and customs. And it seems to me that as long as the European Union remains a relatively loose confederation of nation states, then immigrants ultimately will be learning the customs, the laws, and the languages, not of Europe, but of nation states. There's just no getting away from that.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Rob is on the line from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to point out that there's a comment made before about the secularness of Europe and the fact that religion has been kind of shunted into the background and the holding up of the United States as a model of successful immigration. I wanted to point out that immigration to the United States always, historically, by and large, has been a Christian or a Judeo-Christian immigration. And whereas in Europe, what you have now largely is a Muslim or Islamic immigration into what was a Judeo-Christian society, such as it is. And I'm wondering how everybody feels about that. I mean, if you had, instead of large quantities of Muslims, if you had Christians from the United States or others making up this immigration population to Europe, would there be as much trepidation?
Neil, quickly.
Rob, I think the fascinating thing is that you use that term Judeo-Christian. 100 years ago, nobody would have known what you were on about, because 100 years ago, immigration by Jews into Western Europe and indeed into the United States was a hugely controversial issue. In fact, as controversial as Muslim immigration into Europe is now. I predict that in 100 years we'll be saying, oh, the Islamo-Christian or Islamo-Judeo-Christian legacy of the religions of Abraham. We'll be using just that kind of terminology. These are very elastic terms, and ultimately there is a sense in which assimilation is possible for just about any immigrant culture, provided it's prepared to make that effort.
You are listening to The Connection from NPR. Oz, do you feel that this is that the controversy lies strictly in the fact that it's Muslims, or has there been a change? Was the initial resistance to Turks in Germany because of perhaps racial and ethnic prejudice, but in the current situation where radical Islam is, you know, setting off bombs in Madrid and knocking down the World Trade Center, that now people look at you as Muslims rather than as simply ethnically different?
Well, we had an estimate 11, 12 years ago, we had attacks against the Turkish community in Germany. And when the borders opened first, when Eastern Germany collapsed and the people were asked which group of immigrant they do not like, they answered the Turkish people. But there were no Turkish people living in the borders of Eastern Germany. So we have got a change, especially after the 9/11 terror attacks in New York, and especially after the attacks in Madrid, when terror comes nearer to the European countries and comes nearer to Germany, the Muslim population is regarded as a threat for the inner security of the societies. And so we're just beginning the discussion that had to begun 43 years ago, how to integrate these people in the societies. But We are not too late. We have just to begin now and to develop holistic concepts toward integration, because these people will live here and will also live in the future here.
But there's a really important issue that's been raised there by Michael, and that is the problem that within the undoubtedly benign and peace-loving communities of Muslims that live throughout Western Europe now, within those communities, it is in fact, has been possible and is still possible for a tiny minority of extremists to organize with comparative impunity. Let's not forget the role played by people in Hamburg in the planning, in the logistics of 9/11. And I'm afraid the other thing that Europeans have to get real about is the extent to which their relatively tolerant attitude towards not only other religions but other cultures has actually become tolerant to the point of weakness in the face of a tiny number of extreme militants who are hell-bent on the destruction of Western liberal societies.
Now, that's a big problem.
Go ahead.
But which conclusion should we take now? If you just see the small minority of extremist people and you see that talking about these extremist people and talking from Muslims as a threat for the society leads to conclusions in this society that endangers the inner security and the freedom and the harmony within the society. So what I say is that there are extremist people within the Muslim communities.
The key thing is that the Muslim communities should not tolerate those people, and should we.
I agree. I totally agree with you, but it is not our duty to make the job of the police and to make the job of the secret service. But what we say is we have got to overcome this atmosphere of fear and anger. When I enter a bus or I enter a train and people are looking to me, I just see the fear in their eyes because they consider me as a Muslim. I just say that we have got to overcome this atmosphere of fear, because my life is also endangered by terror and terrorist attacks, because terrorist attacks do not find out whether it is toward Muslims or toward other people. As you saw it in Madrid, also Muslims were killed by these terrorist attacks. My certain issue as a representative of Islamic community is that we have got to overcome this fear of distrust, this atmosphere of distrust and fear, and have to build together trust and have to build together our societies and the harmony in this society.
Neil, are you a historian of optimism or of pessimism? Do you think that in the next 10 to 40 years, as the Muslim community grows, it's a young community, that this will create more problems in Europe?
Well, I'm an optimist and balanced, but for one very specific reason, and that is that Europe is not only opening its borders, and it's only partially opened them, it's also moving its borders. I think if the European Union accepts Turkey as a full member, and I think that's a really crucial question, then I'm optimistic, not only for cultural reasons, but also for economic reasons. I think it'd be extremely good for the European Union on both fronts. But I think if we draw a line and say, oh, actually, on balance, no, Turkey can't become a member, then we will, in a sense, going back to things that Urs has said, be reaffirming a definition of European identity that is too narrow and simply will not be capable of assimilating large numbers of Muslim immigrants.
Neil Ferguson, thank you very much. Neil Ferguson, Herzog Professor of Financial History at NYU, Senior Research Fellow at Oxford University. He was in a BBC studio in London. Urs Üçüncü, many thanks. General Secretary of the Islamic Community, Milli Görüş. He was on a line from Cologne. I'm Michael Goldfarb. You've been listening to The Connection from NPR.